when the first novel came out, Dune, Frank Herbert was disappointed by the way it was received because he felt that some reader thought it was a celebration of Paul Atreides. He was intending to do the opposite. He wanted to write a cautionary tale against messianic figure. He wanted the book to be a warning. So knowing that, John Speight and I, we wrote this film trying to be faithful to Frank Herbert's initial desire. And in order to do so, I use Shani.
Hello, and welcome back to The Director's Cut, brought to you by the Directors Guild of America. In this episode, the mythic journey of Paul Atreides continues in director Denis Villeneuve's sci-fi epic, Dune, Part 2. In this sequel to 2021's Dune, Paul unites with Chani and the Fremen people while on a warpath of revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family. Torn between love and the fate of the universe, he attempts to prevent a terrible future in this continued adaptation of Frank Herbert's groundbreaking novel. In addition to Dune Part 2, Villeneuve's filmography includes the feature films Blade Runner 2049, Sicario, Enemy, Prisoners, and Maelstrom. He is a two-time nominee for the DGA Award for Outstanding Directorial Achievement in Feature Film for 2021's Dune and for 2016's Arrival. Following a screening of the film at the DGA Theater in Los Angeles, Villeneuve spoke with director Steven Spielberg about filming Dune Part 2. Listen on for their spoiler-filled conversation.
Thank you. Sorry, Stephen. I just want to say that it really moves me to see the theater packed tonight. Thank you so much for having taken the time to watch the movie in a theater. Thank you so much.
How many here have seen Dune Part 2 before? I told you. That is great. Well, it's an honor for me to sit here and talk to you. We know each other, but this is the first time that I've had a chance to ask you questions that in front of a very large public and also with a lot of brethren from the Directors Guild of America. How many here are with the DGA? Yay, okay, fantastic. So let me start by saying that there are filmmakers who are the builders of worlds. And we know, it's not a long list, but we know who a lot of them are. You know, starting with Méliès, and of course, Disney, and Kubrick, builder of worlds, George Lucas, George Powell, Ray Harryhausen, I include in that list. Fellini built his own worlds, Tim Burton, obviously, Wes Anderson, Peter Jackson, James Cameron, Christopher Nolan, Ridley Scott, Guillermo del Toro. The list goes on, but it's not that long of a list. And I deeply, fervently believe that you are one of its newest members of that list. But world building is not an acquired skill. You have to have had an exotically imaginative childhood. Denis, what was your childhood like that brought you here?
Actually, it was boring. No, but I will say that I won't go into therapy sessions, but the idea of being in contact at a very early age with graphic novels coming from Europe called Metal Hurlant, or like with authors like Bilal, Druyer, Mézières, Moebius, I was like drawn into at a very early age reading these guys created. You're talking about world builder.
Yes.
These are the founding fathers of science fiction, of modern science fiction, of the I think I was put in that water too early.
No, but it was and of course, you know, you go way back, and we talk about not so far back, Arthur Clarke, and you, I mean, there are so many, you know, Heinlein, there are so many world builders in literature and science fantasy and science fiction. But this is a desert-loving story. I think there's a line in Lawrence Arabia about, you know, why do you love the desert? And what does T.E. Lawrence say? Because it's clean.
It is, actually. Go ahead.
But just for such a desert-loving film, there is such a yearning for water in this movie. For all the sand you have in this film, it's really about water. You know, it's just, you know, the sacred waters that are yearning for green meadows and the blue water of life. You know, you film the desert to resemble an ocean, a sea. The sandworms were like sea serpents. And that scene surfing the sandworms is one of the greatest things I have ever seen. Ever. But you made the desert look like a liquid. And I have to ask you how you and Greg Fraser, your DP, captured this, because just the definition of the dunes, did you have to do what Lean did on Lawrence Arabia? Did you have to wait for the very early morning hours for your shots, or just a very late day when the sun was low to get the amazing pictorials that you got?
We really structured, we didn't use any artificial light in the desert. The idea was, and that's why we shot it with digital, because I wanted to go in very, very low light. We were able to shoot, it's amazing with those cameras, you can shoot, the sun is gone and you still can shoot 45 minutes, or it's like really, we went very dark. It's on film here, and the idea was that each scene, specifically it was in the screenplay, of course, the at specific moments, having spent a lot of time in the desert and knowing the impact of the sunlight, we shot specific scenes. It's created a real puzzle in the schedule, meaning that we were starting some specific scenes early in the morning, jumping into another scene the rest of the day, and finishing doing the X scenes at the end of the day. Like the kissing scene, for instance, is done over 4 or 5 days that were shot at a specific hour of the day to keep continuity. And which specific sand dunes that had the perfect orientations. Each dune, it was like the strangest casting I did in my life, those sand dunes, because we looked, Greg and I, like madmen, trying to find the specific shape in the specific orientation according to the specific time. And Greg used the Unreal Engine to capture some sets on computer to be able to calculate very specifically at what time each will do each shot. You get really nerdy with that, with calculating, but it was super precise to achieve what we wanted to do, because we didn't want to compromise. Yeah.
So you didn't have any actors that were having just said, I'm not coming out of my dressing room, it's too hot, or anything?
No, actually, there was no dressing room. The that's the trick. No, but I'm joking, but because there was like a tremendous... fantastic, I must say, infrastructure. The logistic in Abu Dhabi was amazing, because you needed, you shot in the desert, you need a lot of support for the crew, and that it's quite amazing what they've done. They created eco-friendly roads that are not existing anymore as we speak, but they were like to maybe, I think, 18 miles of roads were designed in the desert, and then there were tentacles of sidewalks that were like created for the crew, and it was like a tremendous amount of logistics. So, but actors were, you know, they were so generous, but it's the thing, the impact of the landscape. Everybody were getting back to the hotel exhausted, but a smile, you know, because we've seen things there that were absolutely stunning. Every day it was like, and you're talking about water, the desert being an absence of water, but there's a lot of water in the desert, actually. So,
it was a seabed once.
Yeah, exactly. In the atmosphere, and then there's like it's a landscape that is very moving, because it's so. It's like on the surface, it's an image of death, but there's so much life in it, and that's really moving. Yeah.
Right. I want to talk a little bit about religion, because Dune and Dune Part 2 make such a statement about religion. Those in the South, we remember, you know, they think the next Messiah will come, and the freemen in the North don't entertain such notions. You know, Stilgar, Javier Bardem, he's from the South, and he's ready to pledge his life in support of Paul as the Ussul Madib, you know, the Mahdi, the Messiah. And Paul's mother, Lady Jessica, is going to become the Reverend Mother. Can you speak about your background and upbringing as a Quebecois that focused your film, another Quebecois right over there, that focused your film on these themes?
I just need to explain first that when the first novel came out, Dune, Frank Herbert was disappointed by the way it was received, because he felt that some reader thought it was a celebration of Paul Atreides, as he was intending to do the opposite. He wanted to write a cautionary tale against messianic figure. He wanted the book to be a warning, but feeling that he has some missed the point, or he wrote a second book called Dune Messiah to correct and to make sure that the idea was very clear, that Paul was a dark figure, that he was like he became a dangerous figure. So knowing that, John Speight and I, we wrote this film trying to be faithful to Frank Herbert's initial desire, which was that to make that the film would be a condemnation of a religious colonialism, and that Paul would become something that he should not become. And in order to do so, I use Shani. The Fremen warrior Shani, that is like a character that in the book is more in the background in the second half of the book, and I brought her at the surface. And I had in mind, coming from my background as a Quebecois, the idea of in the 60s there was like a movement. In fact, it started at the age of the at the 40s, a movement that came from young artists. That thought that the church was a Catholic church was too embedded into the politics before the 60s, where I'm coming from, church was in power. I mean, they were deciding, they were saying to people, if you vote for those people, you go to hell. If you vote into this politician is paradise. And it's not a caricature. Where I'm going is that they had tremendous power. And religion, of course, is a very important thing. And meaningful and powerful, but when you blend it with politics, it can be dangerous. And it was at home, what happened in the 60s. It's called the Quiet Revolution, where young intellectuals decided to create a separation between the state and the church. And that Quiet Revolution inspired me to create that session in the Fremen, that the Fremen will not be a monolithic block, but there will be different current of thought, and the youth would like to be independent from those beliefs coming out from outer space. Yeah.
But the Mahdi, Paul is heading toward fundamentalism on his own journey. You know, what happens when you are followed, and when so many people follow you, and what it does to your sort of outlook on the world, and how it skews that outlook often. I mean, I can't wait for number three, because you're going to answer all these questions. I know that.
I was about to say.
Okay, so I'll wait for that. I'm interested in talking a little bit about the spice, because is the movie sort of saying that you know, the war against the spice industry, is that anything like the environmental war being waged today against the oil industry to sort of save our planet? Is spice an environmental threat that's blocking the greening of the desert, or is it the politics of war between the Freeman and the Harkonnens? Although, because spice seems to be the fuel of all intergalactic travel, so it certainly serves that function.
It's always the notion of greed, I think, at the end of the day, is that the overuse, over-exploitation of it, that is the problem. I think that capitalism, in his own term, is okay. It's just the over... I think that, it's really the exploitation of it, that the resources, over-exploitation, that is the problem.
Yeah, because it was like, you know, what do they call that, sort of open mining. And And those machines were incredible. I thought the machines were incredible in the first Dune, but I don't know what you did, but you did something to detail them more this time with the sand falling off the treads. I mean, that was awesome.
Yeah. In the first movie, they were in the sandstorm. Now where they were in bright sunlight, so we had to go a bit more.
you were able to afford more. Warner Brothers paid for more pixels. Is that right? Because of the success of the first film. It's good to have more pixels in our business. Very, very good. I think images tell the story of Dune Part Two even more than the wonderful words that you wrote and your writing partner wrote. But this is truly a visual epic, and it's also filled with deeply, deeply drawn characters, and yet the dialogue is very sparse when you look at it proportionately to the running time of the film. And I'm curious because so much of this is such cinema that I was interested in how you could communicate your vision. I had this problem with Close Encounters. My cast didn't know what the hell I was doing. And that was a long time ago. But how were you able to communicate with your cast how you saw this story being told through your lens? Because they're not through the lens. Only you're through the lens. And Fraser's through the lens. And were they able to share your vision during production? I mean, did they have to read Herbert over and over and over again? How did that work?
It's a good question. I never thought of that. That maybe they didn't understand. The one thing that tremendously helped, and sorry, it's a boring answer, but it's artwork. Patrice, my production designer, did a tremendous amount of artwork to describe the world, to describe the sets. I mean, the sets were constructed, but sometimes with the extensions, there was all visual research that was done. And so I think that I was trying to feed them visually as much as possible. And it's, the screenplay was still, the description, I think, were quite solid. So, and again, but you had the same thing on the Close Encounter. I mean, you shot everything on camera mostly.
But nothing was there for anybody to react to.
Yeah.
They were looking at large cards with numbers written on them, dangling 90 feet over their heads, and through a bullhorn, I would call out the numbers so I could get 400 extras to move their eyes at the same time across the sky. It was really boring.
Yeah,
really was.
But you work with great actors. That's the key, I think. Huh?
Were there any? I just a weird question. I just thought this up. But were there any actors on your film that you think will be directors that were kind of like over your shoulder, wanting to see through the lens, really curious about how you were styling your shots?
The truth, there's one that spent a lot of time. There's someone that spent a lot of time behind the camera, listening. Zendaya.
Zendaya?
Yeah. She's so clever, but she's brilliant and she's a strong presence, and she was always on set, even when she was not shooting, just sitting between Greg and I and listening. So I will not be surprised that one day we learn that she wants to go behind you.
See if Zendaya is available to direct a $8 million film. Okay. Thank you. I didn't ask that question for any other reason except I was curious, but thank you for the answer. look, I found the shots in this film, I'm sure we all agree, they were so painterly. There's not a single angle or there's not a single setup or tableau that's pretentious, not one. And there's a tremendous balance in the first Dune and Dune Part Two, even more than some of your other films, between wide establishing shots, so we know exactly what's happening, where we are, and then going all the way into these tight studies, these super, super close-ups, and yet you relieve that in seconds. You go back out wide again. The film is all master shots and all close-ups.
Yes,
and I think that's just absolutely, I've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, but it's based on the, no, but thank you. It's from the book. The book is a very interior book. It's like when you read the book, it's dialogues, and inner dialogues, and people, you have access to all the inner strategy of the characters. And I tried to convey that by creating a very strong intimacy with the characters and to be as close as possible to Paul and to his emotional experience, his intimate experience. And right at the start, one of the first decisions we've made after the idea to shoot in IMAX was, I said to Greg, I want to go extremes, to have the impact of the landscape on the soul. And so I tried to do that, to play with those extremes like that, to convey that.
Right, and there was also, it was so interesting to really, because this is so much about This is such a spiritual film, and there's so much in the eyes of everyone. I mean, you go deeply. You do studies into their eyes and how they're feeling, and every single character has that moment. You know, the good guys, the bad guys, they're all treated very, very equally, and we all get to make our own value judgments about them. But I think the tableaus of the close-up, the visual studies of the faces were just extraordinary. And you were talking earlier about conceptual art that helped the cast understand the tone of the film. Were there individual storyboards that you had? Did you have tons of storyboards?
I storyboarded almost the entire movie. Wow. Because I wrote the screenplay, and after that, it's always probably the most important moment for me is to be alone with my storyboard artist, and I spend weeks and weeks, if not months, drawing the whole movie, where that's where the mise-en-scène is born, the language, a lot of props, a lot of costumes, a lot of sets and that's where I rewrite the screenplay from the storyboards, because there's always massive difference between it's strange when you go from the word to the image. There's a process where suddenly you face the reality of the limits or the new ideas are born. Storyboard is probably one of the most important moments, and I started making movies. You started making movies using a Super 8 camera. Yeah. Me, I didn't have a camera. I had a friend with a good pencil and my first movies were drawn. And it was always the way I started to dream about film was by drawings. And I'm talking about the graphic novels when I was a kid. Yes. So the idea of the drawing is very important in my process, yeah.
Isn't it interesting, because I work the same way in the sense that isn't interesting that we have a script and we're going to certainly rely on the script. It's the document. It's going to take us through the whole narrative production. But then you start storyboarding, and you ever get to the point where you storyboard beyond the script, and you forget you've written the script, and suddenly you've written a whole new script in storyboards, and you have to go back and conform the writing on the page to the storyboards?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I do. I rewrite. And then there's a saying on set is that the storyboard supersedes the screenplay. It's always the team has to follow the storyboard, not the screenplay. But on set, nature supersedes the storyboard. So what happens very often is we take the storyboards, we throw them, and we improvise because there's something happening in the desert that wasn't planned. It's always the best moment, frankly.
Yeah. I have to ask you about the stunt gaffing. Who did your stunt gaffing? Especially the fight between Austin Butler and Timothy Chalamet
Roger,
at the
Roger
end.
Ewan. Roger Ewan, that is a specialist of martial arts, and that blended different combat style inspired. In fact, we were trying to find each tribe has its own way to fight, and Roger, there's a storytelling in each movement. He's very precise, and it's beautiful. He's much more interesting than me when it comes to talk about the fighting movements, or because he could explain each fight. There's a sub story to all. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, I just think this has some of the greatest fighting in it, and I had the privilege of knowing David Lean. For a number of years, when Marty Scorsese and myself and Robert Harris, we found out that Sam Spiegel had cut 22 minutes out of Lawrence of Arabia after the film was released, and Robert Harris discovered the negative in a disused pinball factory in New Jersey. And when he discovered the missing footage of Spiegel, the producer had cut out of the film, Marty and I went to Dawn Steele, who was the head of Columbia, and we pleaded with her to let us restore Lawrence and put the footage back in after David Lean said, please help me raise the money for this. So I got to know David through that, and which meant that when the film was finished, when David did all the ADR in London with a lot of the surviving cast and got some voice doubles for the cast members who were no longer living, David came out to L.A. and invited me to watch Lawrence Arabia sitting right next to him. I got to sit next to him at the big theater in Columbia. I got to see it with him, with David. And the only problem was David talked all the way through the film. Beginning to end. The film's now like 3:40, you know, and he's talking through the whole film. And the reason I'm giving you this setup is one of the things he most wanted to talk about was how he got rid of the footprints in the sand after take one for take two. And he said first they tried to bring in long poles with brushes, but when you try to brush out the footprints of the camel tracks and the footprints, it smeared the sand, didn't look natural. Yeah. So they had to let nature do it. They had to shut the film down after take one. Everybody goes back to their bivouacs, their tents. And the next morning, the nature's done the job, and they get a chance for take two. Did you have any of that on your film, or did you use digital tools to help you out?
It's a good question, because it's hell. It requires a tremendous amount of discipline for the film crew to where they're gonna. And according to the scene, sometimes you will choose specific sand dunes for their width. So you can take one is there, take two is there, take three, and it's true. And yes, and also we choose also according to the shot, the strategy to do the shot also. But it's true if you broom. It doesn't look natural. So, and the problem is not, of course, we can erase in CGI the footsteps in the background sometimes, right. But if the character walks in his own footsteps or in a foot, then it creates a problem with CG because. Right. So, the most strange and beautiful thing I've seen, I think, as a filmmaker, is to when you leave the set. At sunset, the sun, and you see an army of people starting to broom the sand dunes behind you because the next morning you have to broom them, and they develop good techniques to we call them the greens, but there's no greens in the desert. But the sand people, they were expert. The broomers broomed, and then it's true. You have to wait for the sand, the wind to do that job. The only way was the wind. Yeah. It's
David was saying that the wind puts the waves in the sand.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just like water, just like ripples on water, except the waves stay there. That was just amazing. And I think the casting of this film is absolutely remarkable. Everybody feels like they were born to play those characters, everyone.
I had just one question. So it means that the version that I've seen of Lawrence of Arabia is the one that you...
restored.
Yeah, restored.
Yeah, that's the one that we restored.
Yeah. No, but the one that I've seen it probably in 1987 or something.
That was the one, yeah. It was late 80s. That was the one.
Thank you.
That was the one.
Because I don't know, but I recommend if ever you have the chance to see Lawrence of Arabia in 70mm.
Yeah.
I remember I was a film student. I was 19 years old. I had seen that movie. I was alone in the theater at 2:00 in the afternoon. And it's still to this day, it's one of the most powerful experiences. When you are a film student, it's like a massive masterclass on filmmaking.
It is. All of his films are masterclasses. The Rare Breed I just saw on TCM the other day, you know, his first movie not with Noel Coward co-directing, but his first solo outing. And it was all the signals that showed what David Lean was going to be were there in that film. But I was just saying how great the casting was, everybody. You know, don't have to... When you were writing the script, was any single actor in mind during the writing of the first Dune?
Stellan Skarsgård, Timothée Chalamet, of course... Stephen Anderson was a there's so many and Javier Bardem too.
Stilgar.
Yes.
He was extraordinary. Second, I saw your movie. First person I wrote to was you, and the second person was Javier.
Oh yeah.
So, did you use some of book three and book two? Because I remember in book three, isn't that where Paul rides the sandworm for the first time?
No.
Was that in book two?
Yeah. It's okay. In this first book, it's like, yeah.
Right. Was anything moved forward from the third book to the first two films?
Not really. I think that apart from the idea that I know that it was important for Frank Herbert that Paul would be seen as someone that went in the dark zone, it's like, so the movie in a way is more depressive and more has a darker tone than the book, because at the end of the book, when you read the book, you look at it from a certain perspective. Paul avenges his father, wins the war, and get all the girls. And you're like, it was. I don't think that Frank was. I think it was not his intention. Were not that clear. I'm making a stupid joke. Sorry, but it was not his intention. Were not that clear. And I think I understand why, knowing the story, he wrote Dune Messiah after that. That yeah.
Your story has so much to do with visions and dreams and trusting your dreams. There's a theme running through for me about you have to trust your dreams no matter how off-putting or terrifying they are. And yet when we got to the section, and I knew about this going in, but we got to the section with Lady Jessica in conversation with her unborn child. That was really wicked weird. I mean that was amazing, and I kept thinking, oh wow, they're really locked in conversation here. When Aaliyah is born eventually, is it going to be like Amy Heckerling's film Look Who's Talking? I mean is she going to come out before we see Anya? Is she going to come out with full paragraphs? I mean, I want to see that scene.
But it was an interesting idea that came up as we were writing, that we will not see the birth of Aaliyah, because it's a thing in the book. The Aaliyah is there's the book happens on a more period of time that's a bit longer, and John and I, we wanted to compress time in order to put more pressure on Paul, and the idea that we will follow a female character, a woman that will be pregnant, not seeing the birth. I thought it was like a very powerful figure and something that I not really see. I think everything has been done, don't get me wrong, but the idea that I was fascinated, for me, pregnant women are very powerful, and there was something about that strength and that power that I was really happy to put in a sci-fi movie. Yeah.
Oh, it was great. What do you call the wisdom? Is Bene Gesserit?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's the deep wisdom that she possesses, and also Paul possesses because of his past and his actual roots.
Yeah, it's the idea that in order to make sure that you can have the full power of your intuition, you have to know where you're coming from, and knowing the tapping into the all the genetic heritage, and that's the idea beyond Herbert. I tried at my best to be away from fantasy, meaning that I tried in that context to try to be as plausible. That everything, you can almost explain everything, apart from the fact that is super powerful reaction to that substance that is the spice. You can almost explain everything. I love the idea that Paul is not a messianic figure. Really, it's just that is the context and all the other people perceive him and all the power they put on him. It doesn't have any really magic power. I mean, apart from being uber sensitive to that substance, spice, almost like LSD or something like that, and it enhances his intuitions.
Yes, exactly. Well, this has been wonderful, and you have made one of the most brilliant science fiction films I have ever seen.
Stephen, thank you. It's I
thank you so much,
Stephen. You know you're my master, and that is a massive compliment coming from you. So I thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another DGA Q&A. The Director's Cut is available wherever you listen to podcasts. And please share, subscribe, rate, and review. We'd love to hear your feedback, and you can help fellow film buffs find the show. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is produced by the Directors Guild of America.